Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. I'm listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan. It's Wednesday, August 6th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Cheesh, Hawa Tuxknussum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us on our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. A little behind-the-scenes look in the studio here. Coming up this hour, Juno singer-songwriter Josh Fortenberry is here to share his new single releasing this Friday from his soon-to-be-released album. On this week's Garden Talk, we talk gathering, processing, and applying seaweed for your fertile garden. We have the world premiere of the first episode of the new podcast Outburst from KTOO, chronicling the past, present, and future of glacial outburst flooding in Juneau. And speaking of glacial outburst flooding, we begin today with CBJ Deputy City Manager Robert Barr. For a quick overview of the flood preparedness plans for the city and their work in the joint on the joint collaboration between Tlingit and Haida, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the National Weather Service, and the Coast Guard. Gunath Cheesh, Ha'igudi. Thank you so much, Robert, for coming in. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasi Iti, how are you?
Gunath Cheesh, Boston, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing really well. Really appreciate the opportunity to come talk with you and to all of our listeners about outburst flood preparedness. It's somewhat serendipitous that as we are speaking right now, the Unified Command is meeting.
Yes.
The Unified Command of the City and Borough of Juneau, Tlingit Haida Tribe, and the DOT, as well as all those other agencies you named, the Coast Guard, the Department of Environmental Conservation, the State Emergency Operations Center, the Red Cross, Weather Service and Forest Service, many others. I'm probably forgetting some, but they are meeting as we speak. And that's the result of really months of preparation, kind of culminating in today's meeting, lots of tabletop exercises, planning work that has gone into that. And of course, our primary goals being to protect life and safety first and foremost, protect infrastructure, and also to offer clear and regular and efficient and effective communication to the public so that everyone has all the latest and all the best advice and guidance as we head into what we now think of as our flooding season.
Yeah, the floodings. And it was 1 year ago today, tonight,
it was.
Later tonight that it this happened. Yeah,
you're right. It was. And when we look at the basin monitoring page, which is a great place for folks to go if they want to see mm-hmm. kind of the status of the basin and how full it is and when it is projected to be full and what a release today would look like. When you look at what a release today would look like, it would be very similar to what we saw last year in terms of river status.
Yeah, and I pulled up the page for those who are on the live stream. You can see, and this is from JunoFlood.com. You can see the flood forecast. It shows a picture of the basin with, you know, different years and where it was versus where it is right now. And it looks like as of 2:30, we were at about 1349 and a half feet or so.
Yeah.
And what does that mean in terms of where we were in comparison to previous years?
You know, one of the things, this is a great visual that's on that page, is there's a little marker where you can see like where the basin was at in 2023 and in 2024 when it released. So
yeah.
We're really close to that mark.
Yeah.
There's so many variables that go into determining, into projecting and forecasting what a release would look like. And that's the amount of water in the basin is, of course, one of those variables. And it's the one that we can most easily understand because we can track it. We have those tools out there to see it, cameras, laser levels, et cetera. Another big variable is how fast does it release? That's the one that we understand less well because we can't see underneath the basin. We can't see that channel that forms. We can't understand how quickly it forms, how wide it gets. So that's another one. Of course, another one is what's the current status of the lake and the river when the basin does release. So that's another variable that goes into that eventual forecast that we will see and that we at the National Weather Service, one of our key partners, will make once the basin starts releasing. Once the basin starts releasing, all of those, you know, the best information that we have around all three of those and other variables will get put into that National Weather Service model. And they will then say, okay, this is what it looks like. It looks like we're going to see a 15.8, a 16.1, whatever, foot event. And here's how that translates on our inundation maps. And importantly, when that basin starts releasing, that will be one of our first uses of the wireless emergency alert system. So that's when every phone in Juneau that has access to those wireless emergency alerts, which should be everyone, will get notified. We also really, really would one of our key messages right now is to ask the public to sign up for emergency alerts. So there's kind of two types, right? There's that wireless emergency alert, which we can push to every phone. We don't want to do that all the time, though. We'll do it during kind of key points in time. When the basin starts releasing is another one. When the basin is full, we'll do one of those as well. But for folks that would like more regular updates about, you know, what the Unified Command and the Joint Information Center is getting up to, and, you know, information about, you know, all the stuff that's on our website, really, which is a great place to go to. It's bit.ly/JunoFloodReady. You can sign up for emergency alerts, too, at that website, at bit.ly/JunoFloodReady.
That's a great website there. I pulled it up. Just shows you kind of where it is, tells you the current risk, which it says elevated right now, right? Definitely elevated. And there's a link right there. Sign up for emergency alerts on the right side of the page, and you can enter your phone number and you'll get those alerts. So that's a good update for folks in terms of where we're at now. What's the difference between previous year's preparedness and this year's preparedness? Because you're mentioning people have been meeting for months and months and figuring this all out. How much more prepared are we?
I would say we're a lot more prepared. So we are operating again in a different emergency operations center, a different command structure this year. It's a true unified command. In previous years, you know, we've operated, we being CBJ, have operated incident command. Clinkett and Haida has operated an incident command. DOT has operated an incident command. And of course, we had liaisons between those different incident commands so that we all kind of had coordination going on and understood what each other was doing and supported each other as we were able. But this year, it's a true unified structure. There is one command, and all three of us are partnered in that and working super closely together in the same facility. Out at Clinkett and Haida's Public Safety Building is one of our key locations. And that really just improves that communication and coordination effort beyond just what a liaison officer between our individual commands can accomplish. We're really one, and that structure is populated with staff from all three of our organizations.
Yeah, it's one thing to communicate across a distance, but it's different to communicate in the same room together, right?
That's so right.
It's definitely helpful to have it, everybody together.
It helps quite a bit.
Yeah. So I know we've heard a little bit about evacuation advisories potentially. What's the trigger point for an evacuation advisory?
Yeah. So an evacuation advisory will go out when the basin starts to release.
Okay.
So that's when we'll push that out. You know, we'll push out one of those wireless emergency alerts before that, once the basin is full. It's possible that the basin could release before the basin is full. That's not normally what we see recently, but we've certainly seen that in the past. So, you know, we're operating on kind of like a ready, set, go model in terms of how we communicate. That's a pretty typical model. It's possible to go from ready to go if the basin starts to release before it fills up. So there's a little bit of nuance there, but once the basin starts to release, that's a key trigger point for us. That's when our evacuation advisory will go out. That's either then, or if it happens first when the basin starts to fill or when the basin is full, that is when we will have the evacuation zone modeled so that people can understand if they're in it or not. That'll be kind of be a key piece of information. And lots more information about evacuation, again, on our website, on that bit.ly/JunoFloodReady website, including information about, You know, where do people go? Floyd Dryden. What about pets? Well, Juno Animal Rescue is our partner for pets, and there's information about how that works and how much it costs. There's a small fee for that, $5 a day for cats, $15 a day for dogs.
Right.
What about cars, right? There's like, we have a handful of partner churches that are generously providing their parking lots for people to park their cars in so their cars don't get damaged by floodwaters if we see floodwaters in the neighborhoods, which we hope we don't, right? We're confident in the HESCO barriers, but we're not... We're confident in them, but we're not going to bet on it, right?
Right.
Right. We want people to evacuate because it's possible they might not work. We don't know. It's a man-made device, and we're talking about nature here. So, we've done everything we can to be confident in them, but we want to protect as much as we can protect, and that means evacuating. So, yeah, cars, vehicles, lots of churches that are helping us out with that. And a kind of a key point there is that those churches would like people to register in advance so that they know how many cars to expect and, you know, when a particular parking lot is full or projected to be full. So lots of good information about that for people who might be affected on our website.
Great. And is there going to be, in terms of the evacuation advisory, will it depend on how big the flood might be? Certain areas will say, hey, your area is going to be affected first. Will it be in stages or will it be an overall advisory?
It will be based on our flood inundation mapping model.
Okay.
So we will take the information, the most recent information that the Weather Service collects at the time of when the basin is full or when it starts releasing, if that happens first. And then that will inform We'll plug that into the model that's on our flood inundation map website, which again you can access through Juno Flood Ready, and we'll use that to push out. Okay, here's a link. Here's where you can go see what the evacuation zone is.
Okay.
And of course we'll be a little bit conservative with that, right? Because
right.
The model is the model, and models aren't perfect.
Mm-hmm. Right, for sure. Okay. And I know we've talked a little bit about all the agencies coming together. Are there specific jobs for each agency in terms of how they're coordinating? I mean, how did this partnership sort of come about?
Yeah. So in a unified command structure, there's lots of detail there, but there's four main branches, right? There's an operations section, there's a finance section, there's a logistics section, there's a planning section, and each of those sections have lots of jobs within them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the advantages of being unified is that really no one agency, we do our best, but no one agency has enough people to fully staff every position in an incident command structure for multiple operational periods, you know, day after day.
Right.
So it really increases our capacity by pulling all together, and then we each plug our own staff. It's a little bit dependent upon their training, right? We both us and the tribe and DOT all regularly participate in training to get ourselves up to speed on what are the requirements of each of those positions and then plug them into the best fit.
Perfect. So where, I know you mentioned, give us the bit.ly again, it's bit.ly/JunoFloodReady.
It is.
Okay, that's the best place for people to go.
Yep.
And then there you can also sign up for the alerts, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And the Juno Flood Ready, it is case sensitive. So Juno Flood Ready with capitals in the Juno and the Flood and the Ready.
Oh, okay.
Key piece of information. We're actually working on changing that. I had hoped to have that change right before we started talking so that either one would work. So either one might work, but that's our quick link. Juno Flood Ready. It's a bit-ly
link. So interesting because usually the internet's all just, you know, case insensitive, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
so
yeah.
funny.
Yep.
But of course, you can also just Google juno.org emergency flood response, and I'm sure you'll get the website.
Absolutely.
And you can also go to junoflood.com if you want to watch some of those maps. In terms of how it's going. You can also visit kto.org/flood to get the latest on this year's flood, as well as see a video published today about the collaboration that Robert spoke about between all of the various agencies, Tlingit and Haida, Department of Transportation, the Coast Guard, everyone, and it gives a little bit of an overview of how that collaboration is working. So thank you so much for coming in. Is there anything else that you want to let the folks know about?
Yeah, I think the last thing I would plug is that, you know, another one of our key messages this year and last year too, to the just general listening public is once the flood begins, and even really starting now, please stay away. stay out of the area. If you go to Juno Flood Ready, we have some live stream links on there where you can watch what's going on if you're curious. But please stay out of the neighborhood. You know, we saw last year, you know, some people driving through actually pushed more water into homes that otherwise wouldn't have seen. And, you know, when you, if you visit during during a release, not only do you potentially endanger yourselves, but also first responders, makes their jobs more difficult.
Yeah.
And so we're really big message, and we'll be trying to enforce this to local traffic only.
Great. Deputy City Manager Robert Bark, Gwyneth Cheesh, for joining us today. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Chris. Absolutely. Boston.
Yeah. Sheesh. Yeah. Okay, up next we have a world premiere of the first episode of the new podcast, Outburst, from the KTOO News team. KTOO's Alex Solomon takes listeners back to 1 year ago today, August 6th, when many residents of Juneau's Mendenhall Valley woke to freezing water rushing into their homes. The episode unravels why so many people were shocked by the sudden escalation in the glacial outburst floods that had been occurring for years, and why Alaska's capital city wasn't as prepared as they are this year. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
It's past midnight on August 6, 2024. Many people living near the Mendenhall River wake to the sounds of rushing water, snapping tree trunks, and an eerie cold in the air. At 1:20 a.m., water started spilling in through the back door of the Laurie family's home. Minutes later, the floodwater broke down the door and rushed into the bottom floor. It floated the piano, a dresser, and the bed where the eldest daughter, pregnant at the time, had been asleep minutes before. She, her two teenage siblings, and their dad waded through freezing water rising on the street and drove to stay in an emergency shelter down the road. But Diane, the mom of the family, stayed behind because she was worried about her dogs and guinea pigs and her elderly neighbors whose house was dark.
And so I'm sitting in the dark and I'm just hearing things banging and breaking.
Almost a year later, remembering that sleepless night brings her to tears.
And I think about things I need to do to prepare, but you can't prepare for the trauma.
Hundreds of people in Juneau's Mendenhall Valley are living on the front line of a climate change disaster they didn't see coming. From KTOO Public Media, this is Outburst, the story of how a freezing cold disaster has escalated faster than human imagination and public policies to protect people. I'm your host, Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO in Juneau. This is Episode 1, The Flood Zone. The Mendenhall River started flooding more than a decade ago, but for a while, it was treated as more of a curiosity than a cause for concern. Then, in 2023, everything changed when a record-breaking 15-foot flood hit the valley. A couple of dozen homes flooded.
Stunning images there.
There goes.
To say the least. Unbelievable to watch an entire home crumbling there.
One empty house collapsed into the river. It got national TV news coverage.
That is just one example of the severe flooding that is devastating parts of Juneau. But this is no ordinary flood, by the way. This is climate change on full display.
A condo building dangled precariously over the torrent. The state of Alaska issued a declaration of disaster emergency. But still, when water breached the river's banks the following year, almost to the day, many residents were taken by surprise. The 2024 flood broke the record again, this time cresting at 16 feet, and it was catastrophic. Nearly 300 homes flooded. The federal government declared it a major disaster. But why were so many people stunned? And why wasn't Alaska's capital city prepared? To understand how a disaster that's been ramping up for years could shock people, we have to examine human psychology and how that plays into policy. And we have to understand the science. Let's start there. Unlike most floods, the ones afflicting the Mendenhall Valley are caused by glacial lake outbursts, or jökulhlaups, an Icelandic word meaning glacier burst or run. And they're a consequence of climate change. At Thunder Mountain Middle School, a group of students sits by a large picture window overlooking the river, where contractors are building a flood barrier. Water lapped up on campus in 2024, but stopped just short of flooding the building. This spring, students in an earth science class studied the danger.
The root problem is
Well, it's the Suicide Basin, which is between the Mendenhall Glacier. It's like a little area where water can build up.
That's Vivian Esmail, who was in eighth grade last school year. She didn't know what a glacial outburst flood was before taking the class, even though she lived through them. But now she does. She describes how ice used to fill Suicide Basin, but now the glaciers have melted back and revealed it. Rain and meltwater collect there during the spring and summer. Water pressure builds up against the glacier, which acts like an ice dam, the only thing holding the water back. Once the pressure becomes too much, billions of gallons of water start boring a hole beneath the ice, which grows into a tunnel and can float the glacier.
At once, it like can burst through like an entire large amount of water. That's how these floodings are happening and why they're happening yearly.
Researchers got their first alert about the potential danger of a glacial outburst flood in 2011 after a relatively small release. They took a helicopter over the glacier, identified Suicide Basin as the source, and started monitoring it with a remote video camera. Then, after the first major flood in 2023, when the basin fully emptied, the researchers measured how much water it could hold. But because the glacier is constantly changing, so is the basin. And there's another challenge. The size of the flood also depends on how fast the water rushes out. So the National Weather Service publishes an initial forecast of how big the flood will be using the flow rate from the previous year. Here's what National Weather Service meteorologist Grant Smith posted in a Facebook video a couple days before the 2024 flood.
The forecast of the 15 feet is based on the worst case scenario where the entire basin releases.
But forecasters can't tell how fast the basin is emptying until it's already happening. Aaron Jacobs is a senior hydrologist at the National Weather Service in Juneau and part of the flood forecast team.
After we get some data we can analyze, we will update that forecast on the fly.
He says it takes about a day's worth of data to see how quickly the water is actually moving. And that process is partly why so many people living in the valley had their guard down. The forecast was updated from 15 feet to nearly 16 feet just 12 hours before the flood hit its peak. And not everyone knew to check the forecast again. Before then, nobody knew how likely a flood of this magnitude was, or that it would hit hundreds of homes. Now we know that the 1 foot difference at the lake level translates to a more than 25% increase in water volume coursing through the river. And then there's the human element.
It's really different when it comes into your own life.
That's Elizabeth Figgis. She lives with her partner and cat on View Drive, a dead-end street that looks like a peninsula, jutting out into the river. Some of the properties on her street have flooded over and over again. When the flood struck in 2023, she and her partner were on a boat off the coast of Sitka. Her neighbor sent them photos of their trucks immersed in water.
It was just shock, I think, really. And I study climate change.
In general, people tend not to think that climate disasters will affect them personally, even if they believe climate change is happening. Figgis is a researcher who works in the region to document and find ways to adapt to climate change.
And flooding that isn't climate change based, in my experience, is all history based. So any fastidious home purchaser looks at the entire history of the property that's on record.
When her partner bought the house, they looked at FEMA's flood inundation maps and saw that it wasn't in a high-risk zone. In fact, most homes that were inundated in last year's glacial outburst flood didn't appear in areas of concern on FEMA's hazard maps. The ones that did were in what's called 500 or 100-year flood zones. That means, according to FEMA, they could have expected up to a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. 1%. That's because those maps were based on historical data. And at the time they were made, the highest flood recorded on the Mendenhall River was just 12 feet. Now, after record-breaking floods 2 years in a row, we know that even more damaging ones are possible. We're in new territory with a threat that has quickly evolved. The past is no longer informing the future. City Manager Katie Kester says residents received notice of the impending flood in 2024.
We had a lot of people be like, but you didn't tell me that this was going to happen. And we did. They just didn't believe that it was going to happen.
Those in the area got an evacuation warning via text and email. Media outlets posted warnings and stories well in advance, the city also blocked off some roads expected to flood and coordinated an emergency shelter for people to stay at. But even still, Kester says she didn't expect the danger to escalate from what the valley had experienced the previous year.
I think it definitely caught the community by surprise.
After the 2023 disaster, the city expedited the permitting process for homeowners to harden the riverbanks using large boulders. But without public willpower directing the city government to be more proactive ahead of 2024, Kester said the Juneau Assembly didn't feel pressured to do more to prepare.
You know, while you can say, oh, we should have hardened the bank before 2023, it just wouldn't have been possible. There wouldn't have been the political will, there wouldn't have been the financial will, there wouldn't have been the opportunity to do those things.
Mayor Beth Weldon says the Assembly did try to take action after 2023, but the flood was small enough that the city couldn't get support to help the community.
Yes, it was very dramatic, but it only affected 20 people, and we just weren't getting the state response and the federal response. We did try the same things, but we weren't getting any response.
Since the 2024 disaster, the Valley community has pushed for action. There have been multiple meetings led by residents whose homes flooded, the city, and the Tlingit and Haida Tribal Council. This year, the city put up a temporary levee made of steel cages filled with sand. The levee should protect most residents from floods at heights they've seen in the past, and likely ones quite a bit larger. But some streets were left without a flood barrier. And many residents say they need a long-term solution to feel safe in their neighborhoods. Each year, as the basin fills up, the clock is ticking down for scientists who are trying to answer one major question. How big can the floods get? In the next episode, we'll take you to the glacier's edge, where researchers are looking for answers in Suicide Basin.
Right there, another calving face. Yeah.
Any engineered solution is going to need to know how big could Suicide Basin get. And its current size, double its current size, triple its current size. We need to know how much water we'll be dealing with.
In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon, climate and environment reporter at KTOO. This series was the brainchild of Anna Canny and was funded by the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism. KTOO city government reporter Clarice Larson and I wrote this episode. Claire Strempel, Adeline Baxter, and Lisa Fu edited it. Dave Waldron is the audio engineer. The theme music is by James Crawford and Vance Westlake.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com. That was the first episode of the new podcast Outburst. You can go to ktoo.org/outburst to find out more. That episode will be released tomorrow with further episodes to come. You can subscribe to Outburst in your podcast catcher of choice. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. I am joined in studio now by local singer-songwriter Josh Fortenberry. His debut album, No Such Thing as Forever, was released last year in 2024, and he's about to release a new album this October, but he has been releasing singles, with the newest one coming this Friday, August 8th, along with some innovative music videos. The anticipation for this new album is high, at least in my opinion. You can follow Josh on Instagram or at his website, joshfortenberry.com. That's one R in Barry. Please welcome to the red carpet stage for the new single, Is It Me?, Josh Fortenberry with guest Andrew Heist on fiddle.
Rain starts falling like a ship collapsing. Come sweet depression, I'll be relapsing. Is it just me? Is it just me? Well, I've been singing like a miner's daughter. The season bringing the lambs to slaughter. Is it just me? Is it just me? Took all my love. Took all my love. All my time. away, cause I don't plan on going straight. Spent years acting like I was not there. Spent years laughing when I was laughed at. Don't look at me, don't look at me. I'm not trying to change the world, dear. I'm not crying, no crocodile tears. Don't look at me, don't look at me. Take all my love, take all my love. All my time I have to wait, cause I'm playing on going straight.
That's what I'm talking about right there. And that that's what you call live radio. Have a seat over here, boys. If you heard a loud pop near the beginning of that song, that's what's called a guitar string popping. But
I guess
it's like how you deal with, you know, live music. You just, the show goes on, right? It just keeps going.
I almost came alone. I'm so glad I at least had a fiddle. It sounds a lot worse when there's just dead air. Yeah, for those listening at home, that song is in D in the C position, and I broke my A string in like the second note. So that is my bass note. So I lost all my root notes. And then it just drapes across the string, so I couldn't play anything really.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of there, and then you heard Josh maybe trying to get that out of there. But has that happened during concerts, and do you stop, or do you just pick up a different guitar, or what do you do?
No, you keep playing always. I mean, hopefully you're playing with a band. If you're playing solo, you got to be a little more creative. If you're playing with a band, everyone recognizes that they have to fill the space you just left behind. And if it's like early on in a song, a lot of times whoever breaks a string will sort of step away from the microphone or walk away and change their string while everyone else fills.
Keeps going, right? Because you can fill. Yeah. And of course, you have the fantastic Andrew Heiss, going to Chief Swasiati, for being here, Andrew.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so, Josh, this new album, I became aware of this a few weeks ago because I think you released the first single, City Lights, which we'll play the single and show the video for those who are watching the stream at the end of the interview today. And I was like, oh, this is an innovative video. There was some behind the scenes, like you did something different. For those who will see it later or can find it on YouTube, tell us about how you made that video for City Lights.
Sure. So the song is a little bit about feeling stuck in place. So what I wanted to do is make a video where it looked like the world was moving quickly all around me and I was kind of standing still. So I worked with a local videographer named David Rosso. And what we did was he slowed the track down to like 0.2 speed, so it sounds crazy. And then I was playing the song in my back pocket and walking at like a snail's pace down the street in downtown Juneau. And he was filming me as I walked. And so then when we sped the song up and the video up to normal speed, it looks like everyone else walking is going hyperspeed.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was, yeah.
And did you have designs, because I remember you can listen to a full hour of Josh about his previous album that was aired last year, Songwriters on Songwriters, here on KTO. You can listen to that. He plays a bunch of the songs live on there. And I remember in that interview that you did that you talked a little bit with Was Annie doing that interview with you?
Taylor.
Taylor Dallas Vidick did the interview with you. I remember like you were talking a little bit about promotion and that like that isn't really your thing. That isn't where you like to live necessarily, but you realize as a musician that that's part of the gig, right? So did you go into this new album with the idea like I'm going to try some new innovations, I'm going to do these videos, I'm going to release a couple singles in advance, I'm going to get the hype going for the album? Was this a design that you had on this one?
Definitely, yeah. I'm trying to learn that game a little bit. What was really hard for me is like the day-to-day. So, you know, most artists today are expected to sort of post something every day on social media or, you know, you're spending a little bit of time each day doing self-promotion. That's a struggle for me. Making videos is really fun because I grew up with a mom who was a videographer and I love dressing up in costumes. So coming up with little creative ideas to shoot for music videos is kind of a fun idea. Trying to do all the sort of press and put the word out about the album is still definitely work. But I'm working with a PR rep who's really helpful. And
oh, nice. That's excellent. Now, I know for this new single, Is It Me? It comes out this Friday on all the services. You can find it there. You can also see a little teaser on Josh's Instagram where he's at the Overstreet Park, the Whale Park, as we call it. Tell us a little bit about, is that from the full video?
No, that one, we just did some fun shots to sort of preview the song coming out. We didn't shoot a full video for this one. There'll be a full video for the third single, which is called Nobody Is Pleased. That's a pretty fun one. I'm excited to show people. That'll be out in September. For this one, we were just trying to pick another landmark spot in Juneau. I'm trying to highlight town in all of my videos and promo just because, you know, all these songs were written while I lived here. And so just trying to pick spots around town that sort of fit the mood of the song.
Well, you also mentioned costuming, which I think is interesting because I don't want to necessarily give it away. I want people to go to your Instagram, A, so you get the hits, but B, so they can see it. But tell us a little bit, can you describe the idea around what you were trying to do at the Whale?
Sure. Well, the first thing I was trying to do was find a day when it was rainy, and I didn't think that was going to be a struggle, but we had that nice patch of weather in July.
You should have shot it in May, right?
We should have shot it in May.
Yeah.
But the opening line of the song says, when rain starts falling like a shelf collapsing. So I was trying to get a nice rainy shot in a recognizable spot in Juneau. For various music festivals, I find it's much more comfortable, especially when it's warm out, to wear something that's a little less restrictive than pants.
And we'll leave it at that, and you can go look at the video and see what we're talking about. So you mentioned there's another single coming in September, and then the album, the full album, is going to release in October.
Yeah, I believe it's October 10th. It's the second Friday in October. I think.
What's the title of the album?
The album is called Tidy Memorial.
Tidy Memorial. And I recall last time that you did vinyl for No Such Thing as Forever, right?
Yeah.
Are you doing that again for this one?
That is the plan. I'm working on that right now. I'm working with the amazing Megan Chambers in town and her Saltwater Press business, who's been designing the artwork and the all the design for the CD and the vinyl cover.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And so what's the experience like creating this second? Is this the second album that you've done?
Yeah.
Okay, so No Such Thing as Forever was the first, your debut album. This is that sophomore. Now, history says that sophomore albums, there's always a slump. But
sure.
I don't really feel like Josh Fortenberry's in a slump. So tell us what's a little bit different about this album.
Well, the main thing that's different is for about half the album, I added electric instruments, which I didn't do in the last one.
Oh,
so I have
okay.
Some electric keys played by Cat Moore at Anchorage. Brought a friend up from Portland, Eric Clampett, who's a great pedal steel guitar player. Have drums. So those three instruments give some of the songs more of a sort of country, indie country feel, I guess. And whereas the last record was pretty much straight folk old time bluegrass sounding.
And I remember you had an album release party, which was awesome, over at McPheeters Hall. You're planning something similar?
I am. I'm planning a couple days of shows in October so people can keep their ears out. There will be at least one night at the Crystal Saloon and one day at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. I'm not exactly sure how many shows at each or exactly what they're going to look like yet, but there'll be a big cast of local musicians, and I'm going to try to make it a fun party.
Follow him on Instagram. You'll see all of the promo that he's going to do for it. And Andrew, I just have a question for you because you all are part of the Muskeg Collective, which is a group of four or five of you who are making albums, pushing each other. I know Taylor Dallas Vidick is working on her album. And I heard through the grapevine, Andrew, that Josh is kind of like, he pushes y'all to like continue to songwrite and to continue to push yourselves forward. Is that true? Can you give us a little background into Josh and his ambition?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great thing to talk about because Josh is one of my favorite songwriters, but also one of the most prolific songwriters I've ever come across. And part of how we interact in the Muskeg Collective is sort of bouncing song ideas off each other. And it's amazing how many songs Josh shares with everybody, and it is hugely, I won't say Josh pushes everybody, but I'd say he inspires me.
Inspires, okay.
To sort of get over any sort of apprehension about like getting through the songwriting process and putting something out there for people to listen to. Like, he puts songs out and then he starts writing another song and he's very prolific and is a very supportive listener and gives great feedback and is very encouraging of everybody else to be generating new songs. So it's been really amazing to be a part of it and get to work with him that way.
Because I know, like, life gets in the way, right? We all have jobs. We all have things. I mean, when Taylor was here last time, she had just been up to Anchorage for the first session of recording. We were talking about, you know, how she often will be producing of so many events that maybe it takes away from her ability to work on her own stuff, right? And is there anything for you, Josh, that gets in the way or stops you from songwriting?
I mean, I'd say I sit down and write 2 or 3 days a week, but I think the same with Taylor and probably the same with Andrew and Aaron, all of us who play together. Because you have so much fun playing music with your friends, you have this tendency to join every project with them that you can. And so
yeah.
The next thing you know, you're in 2 or 3 bands. And that can take away time from working on your own stuff. So, you know, and I know, like, Taylor struggled with that a lot because we all want her to sing in our bands.
Yeah,
so it's like everyone's
sure.
trying to recruit Taylor to do their songs, and she's trying to write her own.
Cool. And Andrew, any word on the Heists album? Are you all still working on it?
We are still working on. We haven't started recording yet, but we are still gathering the songs, finishing up some songs that we have been working on and planning to at least have a few more written in the next couple of months. So we have some time specifically allocated to do that, which is a really nice thing.
So maybe we'll see an album in 2026, perhaps.
Yeah, that's the realistic schedule. Would probably be spring, summer, fall 26, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I think Taylor's trying to release maybe in February or something, somewhere in early 2026. So awesome. It's just great. I love our local singer-songwriter community. Josh, thanks for coming in and singing. Andrew, thanks for joining him.
Thank you.
What about the guitar playing?
Well, when you listen back, there's that pop was, I was, your face too was like, you're
he looked at me and I was like, I don't know what
I was almost going to be like, do you want to stop and start over? But I was like, you know what, this is kind of fun just to see how it works. But let's listen to a pre-recorded track. This is City Lights. This is from the video that was released about a month ago, and this was the first single from the album, forthcoming, titled again,
Tidy Memorial,
and it's coming in October. You can go to joshfortenberry.com. that's 1 R in Barry, and you can find out more or follow him on Instagram. Gunnath Cheesh for coming in today and sharing that with us.
Thank you so much. The days go by so quickly now, and soon they'll all be gone, one by one. Still I have said nothing, and I'm growing afraid I'll slip away. City lights don't shine nearly so bright. I wish a door blow would blind me. The winter wind is chilly among the vacant buildings. I suppose I'll never leave. I suppose I'll never leave. Thank you.
I'm sorry. But it's hard for you to tell if I won't get well. Wake up feeling guilty. I keep pushing through the shade to feel the same. Now the city light don't shine nearly so bright. I wish a dog glow would blind me. Winter wind is chilling among the vacant buildings. I suppose I'll never leave. I suppose I'll never
From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Mike Lane. Today is Wednesday, August 6th, and on this day in 1965, the Gatermen, known as Alaska's top music group, recently released a recording featuring original songs Namu and Killer, and the song Whale was written to accompany a new dance called Dive, Spray, Fin, and Dorsal. The group originated in the Douglas-Juneau area, but only Rich Poor, the lead guitarist from Douglas, remained with the group. That's a look back at this day in 1965.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Boston Christopher, and I'm joined by Darren Snyder. And this week, we are talking seaweed. Gunath Chi, Shat Yigidi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see you again, Darren. Wasiyati, how are you today?
Thank you, Boston. Great to be here.
Okay, so this week on Garden Talk, we are going to be talking about seaweed and gathering, processing, and applying seaweed for your fertile gardens. Can I start first with what is a fertile garden?
All right. That's a good question. So usually when we talk about fertility with a garden, we're talking about the soil. We're talking about a living soil. And our goal is to have as much bacteria and fungi and invertebrates all working their way in there, eating things, eating each other, and excreting and making a place that is really a good place for the for them to be living, so that they can the plants can then uptake from what they from their life in the soil.
Okay.
And so a fertile soil is a living soil, and so seaweed is really instrumental with that, and we are very fortunate to have plenty of it around our parts.
Nice. Okay. So how does it play into why would we use seaweed in our fertile garden?
On kind of the science side of things, it provides micronutrients. Plants require 17 nutrients that we know of in order to grow well. Some of them, they need large quantities. Some of them, they need very small quantities. And salts are very often how these transport from the the plant sources to the animals and then back to the plants. And so when you think about kelp and you think about the ocean, you think about salts. And there are very many, many different salts, not just NaCl or sodium chloride, but many of the magnesium and potassium and other really important nutrients are within the plant. And so potassium is actually one of what we call the macronutrients. When you look at a fertilizer bag, if people are gardening and they see those three numbers, it's the N for the nitrogen and the P for the phosphorus and the K for the potassium, NPK, those three numbers on every fertilizer bag. So we're actually getting a good bit of potassium when we're adding the kelp to our gardens.
Okay. And so I guess gathering, as we can talk with gathering, like how do we get this kelp? How do we get the seaweed? Where do we get it from?
Yeah, so it's shorelines and where it's been washed up naturally. We're never picking them off of rocks that where they're attached and obviously growing and anchored. Instead, you know, our tides and our currents and everything really, they end up tearing off primarily the fucus or bladderwrack, the popweed. And you see that piled up along the shoreline. Sometimes they'll be mixed in with bull kelp and other debris. But you gather all that stuff up from those windrow piles. You can kind of, as you get into this, you can find different places that it deposits more or less and when, according to the tides and everything. But you can gather it up at any point, and I like to fill it with fill 5-gallon buckets. You don't have to fill it all the way up, or you can, and you carry one on each side, and you can go up and down the beach and fill them up pretty quickly if you find a place where there's a lot of it.
When you said you don't want to take it off of a rock, is it because it's at that point? Is there a difference between it being on the beach, let's say, or on the ground and being on the rock? Is it living when it's on the rock and it's not when it's on the ground?
Well, they are anchored and they have what are called holdfasts.
Okay.
And so it's a root-like structure, but it's not absorbing nutrients. It's just holding on to something. So they're not pelagic. They don't just go all over willy-nilly. Once they're torn free, then it may be a living plant still. Many times they are, but they're certainly on their way to just being washed up on the shoreline and becoming part of the land environment or just being disintegrating into the water. But that's our chance to get them.
Is it better to, I guess I'm kind of answering my own question here, but getting this naturally, gathering this kelp, this seaweed, is better than like pre-bought.
Well, yeah, you can buy products, and they are that have been processed and mostly just dried and ground up into a powder form. There are some liquid forms, and you can buy that, and it's very convenient. And there's a product, I'm not endorsing it, but people may have heard of MaxiCrop, but that's been around for years, and people will even do foliar applications. They'll spray it on their plants, and it's been found to be really efficacious. And when we're finding it ourselves, it's just so many more times more of it that we can get, and it's obviously just the only price is your labor.
I guess it depends on, how far into the process of being a gardener you are, maybe, right? Like at the beginning, maybe you don't add that. You do the pre-bought or something. But then I know gardeners like to get in there, right, and make it happen. So like doing this gathering of this kelp is probably really fun part of the process.
If you're going to be a gardener in Southeast Alaska, it takes commitment and of some degree or another. It's really a gift that we have this natural resource here, and the amount of work that it requires is very little compared to the benefit. So I recommend everybody doing it.
Everybody do it, yeah.
And it's pretty easy to do. And I would, you know, and when you're gathering it, you then have your buckets of seaweed, and then you have a few different things you could do with it. I could share.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What's the processing part of this?
Yeah, so you can add water and let it sit for a while and create kind of a tea, which you would then pour on directly onto the soil around your plants. You can use a bubbler if you want to kind of take it a little bit of another step, compost teas and manure teas and seaweed tea. If you leave it in a bucket, just like any bucket of greens, like just using regular weeds and filling it up with water is also something that you could just make a plant tea out of. Mm. But seaweed is special because it does have so many nutrients. When you think about nutritionally as we eat it, and we know that seaweed is very highly nutritious, it's the same thing for all those bacteria, especially in the soil. And so you can make a tea with it. You can also just mix it directly into the soil. I suggest if you do that you do it in the fall so that they can break down and become part of the soil and feed the organisms over the winter. And otherwise, it's kind of clumpy. And especially if you're trying to plant seeds directly into it. I've made that mistake a few times where it's like, I really want to get that seaweed in there. But then it ends up, kind of making voids that they fall into.
Nice. Okay. And that's part of the last step here, the applying in terms of using it. Like you said, you can use that tea. You can plant it in the ground. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that you want to do when you're applying this in terms of using the seaweed?
So I've described so far, making the tea and then incorporating it into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Another little bit of processing, and then I'll get into some of the final application, is that if you can get beautiful days like we have today, the sunny days, and some of the seaweed is drying, then it loses a lot of its water. It makes it, for one, a lot easier to carry a lot more, and you can like jam it into the bucket and break it and crumble it, and that crumbling makes it that much faster that it's going to break down in your garden or what have you. So kind of having that dry seaweed is actually kind of one step towards being an easier product to deal with, as long as it can stay dry. But as soon as it gets rained on, then it all expands again too. So you just have to kind of learn how to manage it. But other than incorporating it into the soil and feeding all those organisms there, one of our common things is to use it as a mulch. So a mulch is anything that we put on the surface of the soil. And it can be bark, it could be plastics, it could be what have you. And it has multiple functions. In this case, the function of a seaweed mulch is that it is providing nutrients as it breaks down and as the rain comes down and washes the nutrients down. It's providing excellent, food for those organisms. It's also, depending on the thickness, can suppress weeds like other mulches because the weed seeds are not being exposed to the soil and neither are their sprouted leaves. And then also in the wintertime, those thicker mulches using seaweed to do so acts as a blanket. And so there's less of this freeze and thaw effect that we are subject to here in our gardens. It keeps it from getting too cold or too warmed up. And so it forms kind of a blanket. So that mulching.
I love that. That's all about seaweed on this episode of Garden Talk. Gwyneth Cheesh, Darren Snyder, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Boston. Take care.
That's going to do it for this episode of Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. You can find the show online at kto.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support comes from Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Grass and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and viewers and listeners like you, never more important than now. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gwyneth Cheesh!